session number 27040, reel 3.
Fred Briggs, reel 3.
There's a one-way passage, as we say in Yorkshire, a snicket, that went past the church. And naval ratings were only allowed to go in one direction. The thinking behind it I never understood, unless it was a case of if so-and-so met so-and-so face-to-face, they might have fisticuffs. But this didn't apply to the normal people in Malvern. They could walk in both directions, male or female. But naval ratings could only walk in one direction, and you'd usually find that the so-called police or safety watch or whatever the name was at that time, they used to spend an awful lot of time there because they used to like to catch people going in the wrong direction and discipline them. But that was all part of the party.
So you left Malvern in September?
Yes.
Where did you go to next?
I went to HMS Demetrius, which in one respect was delightful, in another respect it wasn't. The reason it was delightful was it was located at Wetherby, and from Wetherby to Bradford you could get quickly by bus. So therefore, when I had ability to sort of have overnight stays at weekends or during the week, I got on the bus from Wetherby to Leeds and from Leeds to Bradford, and I was home within comparatively short time because there was no vehicles on the road other than buses. And so to see my girlfriend and to see my family, I came home more than most people. And it was apparent when exams came at the end of the period that those that lived near to Wetherby didn't do quite as well in the exams as the others that stayed swatting. So, you know, it happened. And I just missed out passing for a leading hand automatically by about 4 marks, I think. But weighing it up, I think it was worth it.
And HMS Demetrius, was this the specific supply branch training?
This was the specific supply branch training for writers and stores assistants. And the camp is still there. I believe it is now a prison for youth offenders.
What was the camp like while you were there, though? How was it organised and what did it look like?
It was located about, about a quarter of a mile from Wetherby itself on the York Road, immediately opposite to the racecourse. The entry was open, although you had to sort of clock in and clock out. That's the wrong description of it, but basically that's what you did. You handed a card in, a station card, as you went out, and you recovered that when you came back. I used to have to leave home somewhere like 6 o'clock in the morning to get back to Wetherby at 7:30. And I succeeded in doing it without difficulty. But I slept very well the next night. Not even before next night. But I enjoyed my time at Wetherby, and I learnt a lot, and there were a nice crowd of instructors, and I enjoyed my training at Wetherby.
What was the accommodation like there?
The accommodation was bunks, double bunks, in concrete-built compartments, as it were. Not bedroom, but sleeping quarters. There's two in each one, and it went down in a sort of a passageway, bunk rooms on either side, and an exit at the both ends.
What about missing facilities then?
Missing facilities, they had dining halls where I think the whole camp ate in this dining hall. I presume it's specific. It was specifically built for training, because in the earlier part of the war, the school for and the ship, as it was called, was at Highgate in London. And I suppose when bombing got bad in London, they decided to go elsewhere, and they chose this place at Demetrius, which I think was purpose-built as a camp.
Was there, with the messing, what was the food like there? Was it, as well, was it self-service, or would it be dished out amongst the group?
It was dished out. It was dished out. I don't remember much about the the breakfast always seemed to be the best, because they were the simplest, and because dinners were sort of done on a large scale with sort of meat, veg and potatoes cooked about 3 hours before, it wasn't so good. But I could always look forward to sort of going home on leave at night and sort of having a meal there, which sort of kept me going, I suppose.
You started your training within the branch, the spice branch. Can you take me through your training, what you were learning? You said you learnt a lot. What did you learn there? What was the process?
Well, there were two facets of the supply division. There are naval stores and victualling. And you do both, but I was sort of better, if that's the right word, at victualling than I was at naval stores. I don't know why, but it just worked like that in the exam. My marks for victualling were superior to those in naval stores. And so that sort of influenced your going on naval service, what you're best qualified for when you took your exams.
I take it victualling's, is that food and drink?
Yes.
And naval stores, what does that involve?
Well, naval stores is all parts of issuing things for use, like things that are used on lifeboats, bits and pieces, and this sort of thing, all sort of fittings and fixtures for the running of the ship. And we had off. I'm going to the Belfast now, but we had offices. The I'll show you a picture. The victualling office was there, and the naval stores office was next door. And we had a little hatch to talk to each other through. This was on the Belfast, of course.
So was it a series of lectures when you were Demetrius, or was it any practical work?
No practical work as such, other than helping to wash up in the kitchens, by which time, you know, your working suit was all covered in soup and gash from the washing up, you know, they're going at one end and come out the other, and you get splashed with gravy and God knows what. But so there was no actual working as such.
So were you instructed within the classroom environment then?
Oh yes, with a classroom, and there would be, I don't know, I suppose somewhere I can find it, but there's a classroom, I would think there were about 20, and we had an instructor. He was a chief petty officer, and his name was Austin. Very nice man. I think he lived in the Isle of... His home was in the Isle of Wight. But surprise, surprise, his girlfriend was in an RAF location just up the road, you see. So I think he went... he had sort of sleeping out.
And while you were in the classroom environment, would you be set various exercises to whittle a ship or work out what the naval stores would be, that sort of thing? Am I?
Yeah, yes. The process of when somebody came on the ship, you'd sort of book them in a mess, and the little booklets that you've gone about the Belfast eventually. But you got these booklets, you got instruction. Well, you do this when they come, you do that when they go. In the meantime, each mess is rationed for, say, 12 people. And you get to know how much is allowed for each person and how much you need to give to the galley to make for the whole ship, you see. And how it works on a huge sugar establishment, I haven't a clue, because I never did that sort of thing when I was at a sugar establishment. But on the ship, you get to do this thing, and you get to know it, and get to know all aspects of. And of course, you're rum rationing as well. That's part of the vitamin. And you're either underage, or you're temperate, or you're G for grog. And of course, petty officers get the thing neat.
Do you keep the records on board ship then for rum? Who's?
Oh yes, yes. You're responsible for calculating each day, and it varies day to day. We're going on to the Belfast now, Richard.
Just explain the rum ration.
The rum ration. Well, the rum ration. You sort of work out in the office how much rum you'll need for that day. You might think it's constant day by day if you're at sea. That's not the case. Somebody might turn up with VD, is sent to Roast Cottage, not entitled to any rum, so he gets kicked off. If there's a rating under punishment, he's nicked off. I mean, he can be under punishment on board for something he's done in the mat, or something like that. So it differs. And of course, when you come to them going on leave, you know, there's a whole load of them goes on leave. You have to go through and book them in, book them out, and calculate it. And then, of course, you've also got the chief and petty officer's mess. They're allowed to have it neat. So that's a different thing again, you see. And they're first in the queue. I mean, actually, it's which I did, and the battle, it's not done now, of course. There's this battle, God bless the king, I think I was said at that time, didn't it? And you used to be responsible. And of course, you were responsible for measuring the amount, not only the amount of rum, but the amount of water that went into it, which is twice as much as the rum, to sort of get the ration for the... and, of course, the thing is that you don't have too much left. And you certainly not got to run out. But, you know, that there's we get so sort of used to it. I mean, I stood there with my book, and as each mess came up, the number of the mess... They didn't necessarily come up in the right order, a bit like Eddie Morecambe. They didn't necessarily come up in the right order, so they called out the number of the mess, and they got in a queue. And no, there were no pushing. I mean, if they got there, they were there, and if they weren't there, they were stood at the back, you see. And it worked quite successfully, and there was always sort of the ration given to the petty officer and chief's messes down near the spirit room, which was right down in the bowels of the ship. One thing that always amused me is that what did we stow down in the spirit room apart from rum? Toilet paper. Now, I've never found out why we did this. And I asked this chief about this. I said, why do we put toilet paper in it? He said, well, where else would you put it? Well, there's no answer to that, is there?
With the distribution of rum, obviously you were checking each mess. Mm-hmm. Who actually does the distribution of the rum?
What, measuring it out? We have a, what they call, what the hell did they call him? Tanky. He was normally leading seaman, and he was in charge of the working party that we got allocated each day, but his job was given to him by the chief buffer. We had one leading seaman driver, I remember his name, and one called Dunkerley. I knew them all, of course, because effectively I was responsible for them, although effectively I hadn't got a rank higher than them. But that's another story. And they get the idea of measuring it out, you see, that they've got these various sizes and they know exactly when the supply assistant calls it out, they know exactly which jux to use. And normally they only use, I think it's about three, usually takes care of, I forgot what the measurement, sort of like pints, gills and tots, I think, which are it's 3/8 of a pint, isn't it? Yeah, Tom. Two parts of water and one part of rum.
And is rum used as a sort of bargaining chip amongst the crew?
Well, it is. You know, if somebody does somebody else a favour and they're on rum, they say, coming out for a wet, you see, and they'll go around and they'll either drink all of it. He said, no, you have it all, you see, and it lifts the spirits somewhat. But there's all sorts of... we're still on, yeah.
Was there any opportunities for... within the distribution of the rum for any kind of... well, I was going to describe as funny business.
Yes, you know, it doesn't matter now, does it? The fact is that we had ways and means of keeping a bottle in the office, which, for some reason or other, never got empty, let's put it that way. And of course, you would obviously... if you worked in that office, you know, the chief and the petty officer and myself would all know that this went on, but you just accept it, don't you? You don't say anything, and you're all friends, and that's, you know, that applies, and you sort of... you back your own division against anybody. You're part of it, and you sort of know when to keep quiet and when not to.
At the end of Demetrius, did you have examinations?
Oh yes. And of course, if you got marks, not these. I was reading that nowadays you can get an A level if you get 40% maths. Well, it was above 70%, I think. If you got over 70%, you automatically got leading hand before, automatically after X number. I've been reading through this, and I was going to take leading hand, and I'm not boasting, but I've got it. I would have got it automatically because I took over from a leading hand. And chief asked me to do it, and I said, oh, I'll do it sometime. And I was quite happy, and it wouldn't have made a difference, other than the fact it might have delayed me getting, you know, sort of another 2 months. And with hindsight, because you feel different at one time to another, I thought, well, you silly devil, why didn't you take it? You'd have had a bit more pay, and you could have had an anchor on your arm. You might have got petty officer. But of course, once the war's over, which it happened, you think, well, you know, I'm wasting my time here. Having said that, I enjoyed it a hell of a lot, certainly with the benefit of hindsight. It was a wonderful experience.
Where were you drafted to after Demetrius?
After Demetrius, I went to Royal Naval Barracks at Portsmouth, which is HMS Victory. That was on the 6th of November.
And what were the barracks like down at Portsmouth?
Well, there were barracks, you know, they were so big, so huge. I don't know how many people were there, but it was, you know, that you were in transit, effectively. You sort of couldn't get interested in what you were doing because you were not going to do it for a few days. How the whole thing carried on, I have no idea, but it seemed to work.
I mean, what were you actually doing down there? Were you given tasks to do during your...
Well, you were allocated to... I can't remember what I did. How long was I there? Fortnight. And we slept ashore at Southsea. Funny, do you remember hearing Freddie Mills, the boxer? Yeah, well, he was... There was a short establishment on the front at Southsea for servicemen, and he could book a room and a bed when he went ashore. And Freddie Mills was staying, he's in the RAF. He was staying just one night. I saw him. And it's something that sticks in your memory. But I used to sort of sleep ashore most nights.
So would the tasks that you were given, would they be supply related?
Oh, they were supply. Yeah. I think... I can't remember what the devil I did it first time. I went back to it eventually, didn't I? Oh, no, that was... No. Oh, yes, yeah. There's one thing that I do remember, that every morning, the chiefs of the office, and there were only about four of us in this office, for the whole... I don't know what we did, really. I can't remember. But I know that every morning we went down to the galley and got some donuts, and we had coffee in the mess, in the office, and so we had donuts and coffee every morning. You know, I don't know why donuts, I have no idea, because I never had them before or since in the naval, so there must have been a donut racket going on somewhere, but there we are.
And you were there a fortnight?
I was there a fortnight, yeah.
And what happened next?
And then I got notification that to join HMS Belfast, and I left Naval Barracks on the 18th of November, and it was a Saturday, I remember it was a Saturday. We set off on Friday and went to London. And we stayed in an hotel, I think in Bayswater. And it was sort of a naval hotel, if that's the right, you know, it was purely naval. And what happened, it shouldn't happen, but because you were in transit, you didn't have a bed of your own, which, you know, you're supposed to have. But you sort of say, well, there's only room for, you know, two in a bed, and that's it. And that's the way it was, you know. We stayed overnight, and then we went from King's Cross to Newcastle, and then from Newcastle I went up to the Belfast, which then in dry dock at a place called High Shields, which is the South Shields, North Shields and High Shields. And that's beyond... It was amusing going from the station, because if you go from Newcastle to High Shields, which is the next but one stop, there's Jarrow and there's Hebburn, and you didn't know where the hell you were, because they all had this Geordie accent. They all sounded alike, you know, whichever station you got. And of course it was all blacked out, and I was the lone person that joined the Belfast from that allocation, and I can't remember the name of the aircraft carrier which was being commissioned at the other side of the Tyne, and there were the majority of this train, the whole train load, draft train, but we stopped in Leeds. I remember this. We stopped in Leeds, so. They said, well, you've announced a spare. I said, can we go? Yeah, it's all right, as long as it's come back. the train leaves at some. So I went outside, and there used to be, the post office was there, and there were about four telephone boxes in the city square in those days. So I thought, well, I'll ring my dad up. Rung my dad at Kellett Woodman's in Bradford, and I said, Dad, I'm on my way to North Shields, but don't, South Shields, but don't tell anybody. You're not supposed to know. I said, I'll go see Auntie Eileen. And Auntie Eileen lived up there, you see. Anyway, that's another story. But he then told, you know, rang Joyce and told her that I was all right. I don't know whether he told her where I was going or not, but probably he didn't. But I should be home soon. So that was that. And I was a lone person. And I had to get my... The stage wasn't too far. It was far enough when you're carrying a kit bag, a hammock. And I sort of staggered on, and everything was very quiet. And I passed the... I came in through the gate. And there were security men as opposed to naval men. It was a security dockyard. Went down, joined the ship. And the first thing I did... the petty officer came on board, Charlie Best, got to know very well after on. And he said, oh, he said, I'm petty officer Best. He said, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I thought of turning in. He says, well, you've just time to scrub this floor then. I said, right. So I scrubbed the floor. and then, of course, eventually, this chap puts his head in. And he said, what the effing are you doing? I said, I'm screwed. He said, what the hell told you to do that? I said, Potty, we're the best in it. He said, I'm Chief Petty Officer Towers. I'm your new boss. Nice to meet you. And a lovely man. And so that was that. And afterwards, Charlie Best, I mean, he's merely pulling rank, of course, and showing you his boss. But he's a strange, strange man, was Charlie. Very nice man, met his family. He was in, he had his wife up there, went to tea, and he was very good, but he was an oddball in many respects.
What were your initial impressions of Belfast when you saw him in the Dry Dock?
Big. Big, I think. But in the Dry Dock, he's sort of overwhelmed by it. I mean, to be quite honest, I had no idea what sort of ship Belfast was, because I had to ask. He said, no, lad. Oh, now, lad, I forget what accent he... now, lad, it's a cruiser. And, yes, it was. That was it.
At that time, when you were drafted onto there, was it only as a sort of skeleton crew standing by while she was in?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Mm. It didn't get full complement until... well, that's another story. I fell down a ladder in Dry Dock, but I've got a hurt certificate here. 4-inch laceration on the left buttock. Something skin, subterraneous tissues and muscle. Scars, well, that's scars both here, that's neither here nor there. But there it is, and that was 12th of April.
What had happened? Because obviously you were in Dry Dock for quite some time with Belfast. I know she was refitting for the Far East.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I fell down the hatch, really. No, that's the wrong side of it. But... if you take a picture of the Belfast, that's the port side again. I want one really of the starboard side, because in the starboard side, going down the starboard waist, as it's called, that's the quarter decks at this end, the forecastle's at that end. But halfway down there is a cofferdam. That's the surround cofferdam. And to get to one of the stores, it's at that side of the ship. So I was walking back, I don't know where I'd been, I was walking back this way, and I had to call in this store down there. I think I'd been stored up for us, up after something. And I got over this cofferdam, and it's like a hole with a plate around it to put your feet on. And I don't know what happened, other than the fact I lost my footing and I fell. My first fall was on a steel thing, rivet type thing, without any chain at the bottom, without any chain, because it had been stripped off for some reason to be replaced, but it hadn't been replaced. And I sat with my backside on that. And there was a stoker there, and he lifted me up, put me over his shoulder and carried me to sick bay. And then I went straight into hospital and had an operation immediately. And I could see it. I was lying.